Freedom of religion has been a defining pillar of American society since its inception. But how true is it? While Americans are free to practice any religion or no religion, it does not mean all faith practices are treated equally among the government and the general public. Historically, the United States has left little room for religions beyond the big three: Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. But today there is a rise in people who choose to practice lesser-known religions or no religion at all. This changing landscape of faith practices in this country has caused Americans to re-examine the way both major and minor religions are treated and the role religion should play in government and daily life. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Whether you are religious or not, religion is ingrained within the fabric of American society, and it can reveal collective ideas about morality and values. Today, we discuss three facets of religion in modern America. We'll look at how a religion created in the United States hasn't always been treated with religious equality, how we might rethink the way we read the Bible so we don't use it to harm others, and why atheism and even Satanism deserve a place in the public square. First up, a conversation about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a religion formed in the United States that reflects the uniqueness and the challenges of this country. McKay Coppins is a staff writer at The Atlantic. We talked to him in January about Mormonism in America from its inception to the present day and how this religion is reckoning with its history, much like its birth country is. His article, The Most American Religion, was published in The Atlantic. McKay, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on.
You remind us that starting almost 200 years ago, people were predicting this religious movement would implode on itself. That has never come close to happening. How fast is the church growing these days around the world?
Yeah, if you look at the numbers, it attracts an average of 700 new converts per day. It is, I think, around 16 or 17 million members worldwide. And the majority of those people live outside of the United States now. But the faith still, for all its aspirations to become a global religion, and in many senses it is, still, you know, adheres to its American roots and its American history, and in many senses remains a very American religion, even as it continues to expand and, you know, has many leaders in corporate life, American life, politics, even, you know, rock stars and Super Bowl winners. That, you know, the church has members in all facets of American life, but still, I think, sees itself as sort of a scrappy underdog trying to gain the respect and mainstream, you know, respectability that it's always craved.
How did Joseph Smith come to receive the revelation on which he built the faith?
Joseph Smith was 14 years old, and he lived in Palmyra, New York, and it was at the time of the Second Great Awakening. So there were a lot of religious fervor, a lot of new sects kind of sprouting to life in the region where he lived. And this was about 1820. He found himself kind of searching for a church to join, and he wasn't sure which one to believe in. He attended services, he read the Bible, he consulted, you know, theologians, and became, as he would write later in his own personal history, kind of consumed with the question of how to save his soul. And in his own account, he says that one day he read in the book of James, "If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, and it shall be given him," a famous verse in the New Testament. And kind of determined to test the thesis, he walked into a grove of trees near his family's farm and knelt down to pray. And according to his account, his answer came in the form of a revelation by God. He describes two figures appearing to him, God and Jesus Christ, who essentially tell him not to join any of the churches and that he would be the leader of Christ's church being restored to the earth.
Certainly some people could hear that message and want to follow Smith. Some people might not believe it. But why were Smith and his followers persecuted from the earliest days? What was it about his message that seemed to have upset people?
Well, a couple of things. One is that, you know, a lot of this is kind of a proto, you know, NIMBYism, not in my backyard, Joseph Smith. You know, if you had a self-described prophet arise in your community and start attracting converts and building a faith in your town, you might be a little bit unnerved by that. And certainly he faced that. He also taught from the very beginning that his people would be a gathering people. That is, he didn't want to spread the gospel kind of far and wide and have people sort of practice the faith wherever they lived. He thought that early converts should gather together. So as people were converting to this faith, they were moving to where he was living. And so he was very visible to the people in his communities. But, you know, also I think that, frankly, claims of the sort that he made were alarming to people, and especially to other religious leaders or clergy who felt threatened by this kind of charismatic young man who was telling stories of angels and heavenly visitations and building a church. You know, there were already kind of established ideas about what Protestant Christianity should be, and he was kind of flouting them. His theology that he taught was profoundly optimistic. It stood in kind of in stark contrast with some of the Calvinist inflected doctrines of the day.
I find the optimism of Joseph Smith really intriguing. If it were me, people in my community were like, we don't want you and your kind. I think I might have said, forget it. But he had this, he retained this enormous faith in the promises of the Constitution to deliver on its commitment to freedom of religion, despite the fact that for years on end, that was denied him.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's almost inspiring and sort of heartbreaking when you read about the early years of his movement, because Joseph Smith, though he started in New York, the early Mormons were sort of driven from one community after another. And they were eventually driven to Illinois, where they resettled. And Joseph Smith believed that if he could alert the nation's leaders to what was happening to this religious minority, everything would be set right. And so he actually led a delegation to Washington, D.C. in 1839 to kind of seek redress from the federal government. And he got a meeting with Martin Van Buren, who was the president at the time, and sort of presented him with this list of offenses committed against his people. And again, he was sure that he believed in the Constitution. He believed in the American idea. He knew his people had been wronged and was sure that Van Buren, when he heard about this, would fix it. And instead, Van Buren made the political calculation that this was a kind of strange religious sect that didn't have very much political power, and that if he stepped in to help them, he would face a backlash from Missourians. And so he decided to dismiss the appeals. According to Smith's account, Van Buren actually said, "Your cause is just, but I can do nothing for you." Mm-hmm. And it was at that moment that Joseph Smith and his Mormon followers started to become kind of radicalized.
Radicalized in what way?
A few things happened. For one, Smith started to realize that the government and the Constitution were not going to protect him. So his own leadership kind of took on a more theocratic bent. He started to introduce the ancient practice of polygamy among his followers. And he even at one point convened a group of men in the church to draft a replacement for the U.S. Constitution, arguing that it had failed them and that they needed a new document that would protect, you know, godly people and religious people like them. And so up to this point, Joseph Smith had kind of seen himself as a patriotic American. Now he kind of realized that America was not going to protect him. And so that's where this kind of tension was planted.
You start this article with a meeting you had with Russell M. Nelson, who is president of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He sounds like an incredibly energetic guy who happens to be 95 years old, which is to say his formative years were during the Great Depression. Does he have a role in selecting his successor, and how interested has he been in sort of assessing where the church is in comparison to modern American values?
I think what's been interesting about him is that when he became the leader of the church, is termed the prophet within Mormonism, you know, most people didn't think he would be a transformational leader because he was so old, because he had kind of been in the church leadership ranks for so long. But his has actually been a pretty prolific and eventful tenure. He's instituted a number of reforms, some of them would seem kind of small and maybe inside baseball to outsiders. He shortened the length of church services. But then there have been bigger things. He appointed the first Asian American and Latin American apostles. He ended a policy that made it more difficult for children of same-sex couples to be baptized. And he has, you know, looked for ways to empower women in the church. So he's addressing some of the core tensions within the church over gender and LGBT issues and race. But, you know, he, like a lot of leaders of the church, is an incrementalist, and he moves in a very gradual pace. The church as an institution in the 21st century is incredibly cautious. And while there is a recognition among Nelson and other church leaders that the church needs to evolve, he also is not in a hurry to throw the baby out with the bathwater, as it were. And that kind of question of what is the core of Mormonism? What should be kept and what should be jettisoned? What is important to retain and what is worth leaving behind was kind of the original question that interested me when I set out to write this piece, because I think it's kind of the question that America is facing now as we enter this period of rebuilding after what has been, you know, a very tumultuous and divisive period in American history. The question of what is central to America, the American experiment, and what's not, you know, that's a question that is kind of open for debate right now. And we're all trying to figure that out.
That was McKay Coppins. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic. His article headlined "The Most American Religion" was published in The Atlantic. The Bible is still the best-selling book of all time, but is it time to rethink the way we read it? Although it carries nuggets of great wisdom, the Bible can be confusing, contradictory, and at times downright weird. Kristen Swenson is an associate professor of religious studies at Virginia Commonwealth University. In March, we talked with her about her book, A Most Peculiar Book, The Inherent Strangeness of the Bible. During the conversation, Swenson explained what religious and non-religious people alike can gain from reading the Bible with an open mind. Kristen, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be here.
Right off the top in your book, you tell us you love the Bible and also that the statement itself makes you a little uncomfortable. Why is that?
Yes. Well, I think sometimes people talk about a love for the Bible that assumes that it is this crystalline clear collection of inspiration and lofty thoughts and powerful, deep wisdom, all of which it is, but it is also a very messy book. And my love for the Bible is a love that reflects on its messiness. That is, it is because of some of the messiness of the Bible that I'm most fascinated by it.
Most of us today read the Bible in our native language, but, you know, the languages in which the original texts were written are mostly dead or have evolved so much as to make them utterly unfamiliar. So in other words, that biblical Greek is not the same as modern Greek. What do we need to understand about how translations have been performed from these original languages?
Translation, of course, is itself an act of interpretation. I think anybody who has studied a foreign language has bumped into this. That is, try as you might to have what we might think of as a perfect translation, a one-to-one correspondence between the two languages, the original and the language into which one is translating, it is not always possible. And so with the biblical texts, we face, just as you said, the challenge that the original languages are themselves very strange to us. And yes, in the case of both the Hebrew and the Greek, are so ancient as to be different than the modern expressions of those languages today. And so the ways that people translate has great bearing on our understanding of those texts. And sometimes people will ask me, what's the best translation? To which I have to say, I think they all are together. That is one way to deal with the problem of not being able to read those original languages for yourself is to gather just as many different translations as you can and lay them out side by side. The internet makes this easy for us to do. We can actually pull up parallel translations of biblical text and see where they differ. And usually the ways in which they differ are reflect the ways in which the original languages might allow for different translations. Sometimes they differ because the editors or the translators have very particular ideas about what they think that text really means. And so they'll choose language that reflects the meaning that they have discerned as or decided is the most authoritative.
What do we know about how biblical texts were amended and edited over time and to what purpose those things happened?
Oh, it's such a fascinating study and it's endless. It depends on which ones we're looking at. One of the things that was so illuminating for me when I was studying this in such depth in the doctoral program was how important the Babylonian conquest of Judah was in the shaping of the Bible. And then in Cyrus the Great of Persia's release of those folks from exile in Babylon, the Jews from their exile in Babylon in the development of the Bible. The thing is, it was an absolute crisis of theology and, of course, the nation when this great world powerhouse of Babylon defeated the little nation there in against the Mediterranean of Judah in the 6th century BC. So we're in 587 BC. The Babylonians defeated Judah. The narrative had been that God had chosen this people who settled that land specially, and that God would always be present to them through the temple in Jerusalem. And not only that, but that someone from David's line would always be king in Jerusalem. When the Babylonians defeated Judah, they, of course, ended that monarchy, and they raised the Jerusalem temple. So R-A-Z-E-D, in other words, they destroyed it. And so that was hugely problematic for ideas of God's strength, God's presence, God's interest in this people, God's veracity. Did God lie by saying that God? So a lot of what we find within the Hebrew Bible is a reckoning with that crisis, a trying to figure out how it could be that the people would suffer such a humiliating defeat, and what happened with God in that. So we see traces quite clearly of editing, especially in the books, we call them of the Deuteronomistic history. They're books of history, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, that were definitely redacted after that event in order to kind of help us think differently about, help people then think differently about the prophets as well. And then all of those literary initiatives and those efforts to make some theological sense of that crisis inform the New Testament and ideas about Jesus as well. So it is fascinating.
Kristen, there are some, for lack of a better word, plot holes in the Bible. The first one that trips people up is where the wives of Cain and Abel, sons of Adam and Eve, could have come from. Why do you think the Bible makes no effort to solve this question that surely would have occurred to anyone who has ever heard the story of Cain and Abel?
Well, I think that in that question maybe lies the answer. That is, maybe they didn't really care that much. Maybe because I firmly believe that whoever's responsible for the final form of the Bible as we have it were very smart people who were very well informed in their world, and they then made choices. And so they also would have seen that this wouldn't jive as a kind of chronological narrative. So maybe they were up to something else. Maybe they were interested in telling different kinds of things. So I think that, again, we have to sort of check our modern sensibilities a little bit at the door, that is, or recognize when our modern sensibilities may lead us to assume the Bible should say or do a certain thing, when in fact it does something quite else and try to take it on its own terms.
It's one thing to consider the inconsistencies in the Bible if we're reading it without feeling the need to believe what it says. What do believers gain by recognizing that there are multiple sources of its writing, that it is designed, perhaps, maybe that's the wrong word, to be read as if in conversation?
Yes, I think they gain a great depth to their faith. So I come from a perspective of faith. I was raised, born and raised Protestant Christian, Lutheran to be precise, and I continue to identify as Christian. For me, thinking about those characteristics of the Bible that you lay out enriches my faith. It allows me to believe that God may still be talking. If this is God's word, who says it had to be fixed and that there is no further engagement with it? On the contrary, I can accept it as an invitation, and as a person of faith, I can accept it as an invitation from a very complicated God who defies our expectations, an invitation to be in relationship to this, with all that comes with, to argue with it, to be engaged with it in ways that may be comforting and inspiring, but also can be challenging.
That was my conversation with Kristen Swenson, who's Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Virginia Commonwealth University. Her book is A Most Peculiar Book, The Inherent Strangeness of the Bible. So is America really a Christian nation? Our next guest reveals why America isn't as Christian as you might think and the value other religions and no religion can bring to society. Boston University School of Law Professor Jay Wexler joined us earlier this year to talk about this subject, which he writes about in his book, Our Non-Christian Nation: How Atheists, Satanists, Pagans, and Others Are Demanding Their Rightful Place in Public Life. During the conversation, we talked about the struggle for representation some religions have faced and the government's role in including religions besides Christianity in the public square. Jay, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for inviting me on the program. I'm really excited to talk to you today.
Considering how often we invoke the Constitution to defend freedom of or freedom from religion, the word itself appears only once and only in the Bill of Rights?
That's right. In the First Amendment, it says this: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And that's basically... There is another part of the Constitution which says there should be no religious oath or test for office. Other than that, that's about all the Constitution says about religion.
Has the Supreme Court ever attempted to define what counts as a religion?
The Supreme Court has tried very hard to not do that, actually. I love telling that to my students, like on the first day that we talk about law and religion. The Constitution says religion right there in the First Amendment, and the Supreme Court has never defined it for constitutional purposes. I think because if you do define it, it's just a very difficult task to come up with kind of an abstract definition of what religion is and then figure out and have that definition kind of cover everything that really is a religion and leave out the things that are not a religion. So I think the Supreme Court is going to try to stay out of that debate as long as it can.
So we'll just know it when we see it, in other words.
It's basically what the lower courts do when it comes to religion.
All right, the first case you examine in this book happened in Pleasant Grove, Utah in the late 90s. Members of a religious group called, you'll have to correct my pronunciation, called the Summum?
I call them the Summum. I think they're called the Summum.
Okay. They reasoned that if their town had installed a public monument to the Ten Commandments, they should be able to ask for one that honored their own seven aphorisms. Tell us a little about the Summum and their aphorisms.
The Summum are a fantastic group, very small religion in Salt Lake City, formed in the mid-70s when a guy, his name was Corky Ra, had a dream or a vision that he was visited by sort of supreme beings, and they sort of told him about the real meaning of life. I mean, I'm simplifying and not getting it exactly right, but he believed he saw these supreme beings, he learned from them, and they taught him about these seven aphorisms, and he started a religion, and they meet in Salt Lake City in this sort of west side of Salt Lake City. you drive around there, you'll come to one yard that's different from all the other yards because there's a pyramid in it, a giant pyramid, which opens up like a DeLorean, and you can sort of walk inside. And it's within the pyramid that the Summum do their rituals and worship the supreme beings, the Summum. And so, yeah, they actually think the seven aphorisms were kind of a completion of the Ten Commandments, or vice versa. Actually, the Ten Commandments were a completion of the seven aphorisms. So they thought they should go together. And therefore, if a Ten Commandments monument goes up, they should also be able to have their seven aphorisms up next to it.
So spoiler alert, the town of Pleasant Grove, Utah, their initial response was absolutely not.
It is shocking, you know, that they would say, well, yeah, the Ten Commandments is okay. But no, not the seven aphorisms. And the reason given was that the seven aphorisms are not like the Ten Commandments in that they're not related to the history either of Utah or to the United States, which is kind of the sort of fictional, I think, justification for why it's okay for the Ten Commandments to be on public property.
How has the court ruled on questions of the constitutionality of prayers before government bodies? What makes it constitutionally acceptable for someone to come in and say a prayer at the start of a city council meeting, for example?
Right. So the Supreme Court has held in two cases that that's okay. And basically the real root reason is because... And the Supreme Court decided this in a case from the 80s called Marsh versus Chambers involving the Nebraska legislature. Basically, people have been giving opening prayers before legislative sessions, in particular in Washington, D.C., in the United States House and Senate, since 3 days before the First Amendment was ratified. So, in other words, the House, for example, had hired a chaplain, and that chaplain had given a prayer to open up the House of Representatives before the First Amendment became law. And so the Supreme Court looked at that and said, well, if the practice existed at the time that the framers wrote the First Amendment and ratified, the First Amendment was ratified, then it must be constitutional to open up a prayer, a legislative session with some sort of a prayer. And that's what the Supreme Court held in the Marsh versus Chambers case. And then it expanded that analysis to extend to beyond just legislatures into town board meetings and things like that in a case called Town of Greece versus Galloway, which was just about 5 years ago.
I want to talk about the Satanic Temple, which is often abbreviated in conversation to TST. We should note that what people outside the religion believe to be true about it tends to be shaped by like Hollywood and the internet rather than any actual investigation into its beliefs and practices. How have you found in looking at cases over the years that TST gets mischaracterized for purposes of court fights and that sort of thing?
Right. So TST is a lot of different things. It's a new group. It started in 2012, but it already has, according to some estimates, 100,000 members. And so one thing to note is that the members are very different. Some people have joined the Satanic Temple for reasons having nothing to do with Christianity, but maybe just looking for community, or they like the tenets or whatever. So it's very hard to generalize and summarize what TST stands for. But they have gotten a lot of media attention for their kind of First Amendment campaigns, things like trying to get a monument of a goat-headed occult figure put up next to the Ten Commandments in Arkansas, for example. And those are the things that make the news. And that's what people learn about the Satanic Temple. And they often will think, well, this is kind of like just a prank group that's there to troll Christians and sort of use the courts as a platform for performance art or something like that. And I think there's a little bit of that in the Satanic Temple, but there is also so much more. I mean, I think when you look into the Satanic Temple, meet members of the Satanic Temple and understand why they have joined the temple, you understand that the TST is a religion like most other religions. It has lots of different people doing lots of different things, rituals, community. They have, of course, ethics, they have theology. So it's not just a simple prankster group by any means.
Have the courts ruled in favor of TST to have equal access to the public square?
There was one case in which I think it's from Scottsdale, Arizona, in which the Satanic Temple lost the claim, but the court held that they were a religion. And the IRS has also said that they are a religion. So there haven't been many cases involving the Satanic Temple that have gone that's a decision, but there are a few.
Have you found evidence, Jay, that efforts by Muslims or pagans or Satanists or any other group to lay claim to the same rights as Christians tends to push governments in the direction of banning all public square religious expression or all use of public resources by religious groups?
Yes, and especially the Satanic Temple has that effect, right? It's fascinating. You know, atheists can ask for an atheist bench on public property or to give an atheist invocation, and it makes some people upset, but usually it doesn't result in the government shutting down the program entirely. But when the Satanic Temple gets involved and basically asks, for example, to give an invocation to Satan in front of a town board, that tends to have the effect of making people really nervous. And, you know, I understand that. I mean, Satan obviously has a lot of connotations and meanings. And it's not necessarily the internal meaning of the Satanic Temple that people understand so much as just Satan bad. And so in several circumstances, including very prominently in Phoenix, Arizona, when the citizenry realizes that because of the anti-discrimination requirement of the Supreme Court, that the city has to allow a Satanist to give an invocation if it's previously allowed a Christian to give an invocation, people start wondering whether they need to have an invocation practice at all. And in Phoenix, they shut down the invocation practice and replaced it with a moment of silence. And that things like that have happened elsewhere as well.
Your sense is that we're better off as a society making room for Christians and non-believers and members of some non-Christian belief systems that some people find downright objectionable. We're better off making room for all of them to be present in the public square rather than none of them. Why is that?
Well, I'm not sure I come necessarily to that conclusion.
Okay.
I do think for sure that having a public square where there are many, many different kinds of religion represented as well as non-religion is better than a public square that's purely Christian. And I think that's really the important question, given that we're not going to go back to anything like a strong interpretation of the Establishment Clause that would create a secular non-religious public square. Were the situation different and the Supreme Court were different and there was a possibility of having more separation of church and state and a true secular public square, then I might prefer that to a, what I call in the book, a religiously cacophonous public square. But I think that's a really, really hard question. And I don't think there's a possibility of having a secular public square. So I've bracketed that issue and just said, more voices are better than one voice.
That was my conversation with Jay Wexler, author of Our Non-Christian Nation, How Atheists, Satanists, Pagans, and Others Are Demanding Their Rightful Place in Public Life. Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Ana Perez, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Madison Hurd, Sriya Reddy, and Rolando Hernandez. You can listen to Think wherever you get your podcasts. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.